Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. Today I'll be speaking with Richard Landis, the director of the Center for Millennial Studies, about Islamic apocalypticism. I'm speaking today with Professor Richard Landis. He's the director of the Center for Millennial Studies and a professor of medieval history at Boston University. Professor, do Muslims have a millennial vision, and do some Muslims believe that this is the end times?
To me, there's no question that Islam is what you could call an eschatological religion, which means that it believes there will be an end time. It believes that at that end time, all sorts of extraordinary events will happen, like the resurrection of the dead and the day of judgment. And the good will be punished. I mean, the good will be rewarded and the evil will be punished. And so there's no question that that is a major theme in the Quran and in Islam ever since. The real issue is not so much, do they have this vision, but when does it get activated? And we use the term apocalyptic to indicate that people think that that moment is near. And then the question is, what do you do if you believe the moment is near? And in that sense, I think that it is safe to argue that within the Muslim world, basically over, well, if you want the larger picture, it would be over the last 50 years, started with the emergence of the State of Israel, which was an enormous affront to a Muslim sense of what the world was supposed to be like. And then in the last 20 years, more or less since Khomeini in 1979, which was really their year 1400, and they have a tradition that there's a particularly Shiite tradition that every 100 years in the calendar, the great renewer can come, who, you know, before he doesn't make it, can be seen as the sort of messiah figure, the Mahdi, after he fails, but nonetheless, you know, gives a shot in the arm to an enthusiastic Islam, is seen as a renewer. So ever since 1979 with Khomeini, and now spreading from Shiite circles to Sunni circles, you have a greater and greater apocalyptic voice making itself heard in the Arab world. And in 1997 and again in 1999, one of the members of the center, who is a student of Islamic apocalyptic, went to Egypt, to Jordan, to Israel, Palestine, and to Lebanon, and collected the apocalyptic books that were being sold the way that, you know, Jehovah's Witnesses and stuff sell their stuff. Or, you know, if you go to ArmageddonBooks.com, he collected the equivalent of what would be in an Arab ArmageddonBooks.com. And one of the things that we were very surprised to see, but was really quite startling, was that, first of all, they're clearly reading Hal Lindsey and the whole rapture tradition of premillennialism in America, the Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson world of looking for, there's a thing on the web called the Rapture Index, and it basically, you know, tracks what events seem to indicate that the rapture is about to happen. So it's literally an index of apocalyptic expectation and intensity. And so what you found was that they were reading this stuff, that they were retooling it for their own stuff, and that literally in the last 15 years there's been a mutation in Arab apocalyptic writing, which goes from the very conservative form of sort of collecting the hadiths from the past, these sayings of the prophet, and, you know, the only originality you showed was the order that you put them in or what you selected, to this discourse that includes flying saucers, that uses prophetic texts from the Hebrew Bible and from the Christian Bible, that invokes everything from Nostradamus to Edgar Cayce and so on. So there's a real transformation that's gone on here, and this is a very lively discourse. And at the heart of the discourse is an enormous hostility to America and to Israel. And it's just ferocious against Israel, partly because the apocalyptic, the millennial visions of Islam are focused on Jerusalem. If you look at Jerusalem in the Islamic tradition, it almost always appears as the site of the Last Judgment, the site of the final events, There's even one hadith that the Kaaba stone from Mecca will be transported miraculously to Jerusalem at that time. So you've got a very strong tradition here that's been dormant for a very long time and has now been awakened. And I would certainly argue that bin Laden is very much in that kind of atmosphere of apocalyptic thought, in which jihad goes from being a sort of more or less endemic state of hostility and warfare with everybody outside of Dar al-Islam, the area that is submitted to Islam and is the area of peace, and Dar al-Harb, the world of the sword, with which Islam is still at war. And now I think you see, particularly, I mean, globalization brings this on, and we see it in the West as well. Globalization makes people think in cosmic global terms. So I think that jihad at this point, in the minds of people like bin Laden, has taken on this kind of apocalyptic Armageddon quality that is just incredibly dangerous.
A lot of commentators on the concept of jihad have pointed out that in the Quran it talks about the jihad of war, of holy war, being a lesser jihad, and the jihad of personal effort to be a good person and a good Muslim as being the greater jihad. They've suggested that that implies pacifistic intent in the Quran, whereas to me it implies that the concept of holy war is actually woven much more centrally into the concept of being a good Muslim than the concept of a just war is woven into the concept of being a good Christian, or of any kind of war is woven into the concept of being Jewish. In the millennial frame of mind, is this current war a final jihad? Is there a concept of a final jihad?
Well, the first thing I think is worth mentioning is that, you know, the whole notion of Islam initially, and I won't weigh in on what it meant in the original text, but as a historian looking at the emergence of Islam as a world religion, it clearly, jihad was military conquest. By the way, we have a website called www.mille.org, and there we have commentary on 9/11, and there are a series of articles by David Cook, which are excellent articles. And one of the things he's got is an argument about the role of jihad and millennialism in earliest Islam. And essentially what you have in his argument, and I certainly, this makes perfect sense in terms of what we know about millennialism, his argument is that the earliest Islamic military victories were essentially the victory of warriors who were destroying corrupt regimes. They were basically going around getting rid of the Persian Empire, getting rid of the Roman Empire, who had been carrying on completely ineffective but very destructive wars for century after century, you know, corrupt regimes that oppressed their people and so on and so forth. And here come these warriors from the desert with an egalitarian ethic who are coming in, wiping out these regimes, and they think that now this is going to be the kingdom of peace. And that's why the area that they conquer is called Dar al-Islam. All you have to do is submit yourself to the basic laws of Islam and you will have just societies. And that's a millennial vision. Now, it worked to an extraordinary degree, but, of course, didn't work in taking over the entire globe. So, on one level, jihad is an unfinished conquest of the world. And I think that it's fair, and I think that every American, anybody who's not Muslim and who talks with Muslims, has got to challenge them on this imperialist vision that the entire world should become Muslim. Because until Islam develops a form that doesn't feel that anybody who isn't Muslim, A, can't be saved, and B, must be, when the opportunity occurs, submitted to Islam in one way or another, until Islam develops a form that isn't predicated on that, the globalization process is going to be very, very painful.
In Muslim millennial thought, is Jesus or will Jesus be a Mahdi?
He was a prophet. I mean, the Mahdi, again, it's mostly a Shiite tradition, but there are other figures in Sunni who would play the role. Jesus is seen as a prophet, like the prophet Isaiah, or even like Moses is a prophet, and Muhammad is a prophet.
Okay.
So Muhammad
we haven't
is
had
the
a,
last prophet.
We haven't had a Mahdi yet.
There have been candidates.
But not right.
For instance, in 1300 of the Muslim calendar, which was 1882 of our calendar, the Mahdi this figure who called himself the Mahdi took over Khartoum, and that's the famous story of Kitchener and Gordon that was memorialized in the movie with Charlton Heston called Khartoum. And that was 1300, and 1400 was Khomeini, and 1500 is in 2076, and I won't be around for it, but we better hope that it's the Sufis who get to take the major role in defining what 1500 means to Muslims, because if it's groups like bin Laden's, this is going to look like a picnic.
Has anyone in the Muslim world described Osama bin Laden as a potential Mahdi? I guess it would be outside of his tradition since he's a Wahhabist and a Sunni.
Well, yes.
But you're saying it's being picked up.
The Mahdi tradition may be outside his tradition, but certainly not the apocalyptic one.
Right.
And almost all apocalyptic traditions, and particularly the ones that are authoritarian and war-oriented, which is unquestionably the tradition that he's in, have a tendency to look for the great warlord hero who is going to conquer all. And that's, in a sense, what's going on with the Crusades. And we have all these descriptions from Crusaders, not all of them, but we have a number of descriptions about the Crusaders that Charlemagne had returned and that he was in the heavens. You know, they could see him in the heavens leading the armies and stuff. So this is sort of the once in future king, the once in future emperor, the once in future messiah. So in that sense, you know, it's certainly, I can't affirm for you that he's formally been acknowledged with some kind of messianic status, but I don't think there's any question that there's an enormous amount of hope that's invested in him. And mind you, one of the things about this stuff, I mean, both for Antichrist and for Messiah, the candidates are, you know, people are looking for who can we attribute this status to? You know, so when Jerry Falwell said that the Antichrist is an adult male Jew, you know, then people are saying, is it Henry Kissinger? Is it, Alan Dershowitz? Is it, who's on the short list? But the point is that you're looking for people to fulfill the role. So even if he doesn't formally say, I am the Mahdi, doesn't mean that there aren't people who believe that he either is or could be.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the important thing, is the kind of yearning and enthusiasm that can be aroused by a charismatic figure who doesn't even have to say, I am God incarnate, in order to have people project that onto him.
Khomeini described the United States as the great Satan, and Satan plays a very large role in Muslim thought. But you say that there's also a Dajjal, or an Antichrist figure in this millennial mythos of Islam.
Right, right. In other words, when Armageddon, when the final apocalyptic battle occurs, and I use Armageddon even though that's a particular Christian version, although it appears in the Hebrew prophets as well. So we'll use Armageddon to mean the final apocalyptic battle. The leader of the bad guys is sort of the cosmic, he's the supervillain from you know, the Marvel comic books. And in Christian tradition, he's called the Antichrist, and in Muslim tradition, he's called the Dajjal. And in most Muslim traditions, the Dajjal, as in most Christian traditions, the Dajjal is a Jew. And in many ways, the particular form of Muslim apocalyptic thinking that we're seeing now, which is pervasive in groups like Hamas and Hezbollah and Islamic Jihad and stuff, is a ferociously anti-Jewish ideology. And I'll just read you a couple of lines, which in fact come from a bin Laden interview, but these are lines that are constantly being used in the discourse of people like Hamas and stuff. We are sure of our victory against the Americans and the Jews as promised by the Prophet. And now we come into it. Judgment day shall not come until the Muslim fights the Jew, where the Jew will hide behind trees and stones, and the tree and the stone will speak out and say, Muslim, behind me is a Jew, come and kill him. Okay, so this is essentially the cataclysmic, enormously violent vision that is circulating in these apocalyptic circles about how the end will come, and the end will come in a bloodbath of the enemies of the true God.
So within this millennial mythos, the Muslims who believe in it are quite likely to see Ariel Sharon as a Dajjal backed up by the forces of Christendom backing up this Jewish conspiracy.
I would say so. I mean, I can't document that one, but I do know that the documents that we got in 97 and 99 expected the Dajjal to appear in the year 2000. And if you look at the descriptions in the Arab press, which incited this intifada, which I call the millennial, not the Al-Aqsa intifada, the millennial intifada, in October of 2000, their descriptions of him, which exaggerated everything that he did. So he didn't just go up on the Temple Mount. He entered Al-Aqsa Mosque and desecrated it. He didn't just go up with a lot of military police. He went up with an army. This is what Dajjal's supposed to do. He's supposed to go and desecrate the most sacred spot in Jerusalem. So, yes, I would say that's true. And now, one of the things I don't want to be misunderstood as saying is that this is ultimately a religious war between Islam and Judaism, and there's no possible resolution. I believe that Islam and Judaism, as I believe is Christianity and Judaism, and all three can in fact live together. I don't think there's anything inherent in Islam, but I think that there is an interpretation of Islam which is, if you will, in the grip of a desperate concern with honor and shame. And that if you interpret the existence of an autonomous Jewish state as an unbearable dishonor to Islam, then you will have a religious war.
There's also a Jewish apocalyptic tradition involving the return of the Mashiach and the destruction of the Al-Aqsa Mosque to be replaced by the rebuilt temple.
Now, if you talk to them, a number of those people, and I'm not saying all of them, I don't want to deny that this violent apocalyptic scenario exists in Judaism as it exists in Christianity. My point is that there are strong other voices in both Judaism and Christianity that have a peaceful apocalyptic scenario, you know, sword into plowshare, spear into pruning hook, nation will not lift up sword against nation, nor study war anymore. And that's in Islam as well. That's a text that they treasure, but you don't hear anybody citing it.
Right.
So there are these scenarios, but, you know, even if you go talk to people who want to build the Temple Mount and you say, well, what are you going to do with the Dome of the Rock? Their answer is God will move the hearts of the Muslims and they'll ask us to build the temple.
Well, there are those who say that, and then there are those who want to blow it up.
Exactly, exactly. So you've got the violent as well as the peaceful. What I'm trying to say is that not only does bin Laden represent the violent, but it's, you know, the guy who was reading all of this apocalyptic stuff used to tell me that it was just incredibly depressing because it is unrelievedly violent, unrelievedly uncompromising. It's classic dualism. We are good, they are bad, they must die. Our great glory will come when we wipe them out. And I'm not saying that you can't find that in Jewish texts and in Christian texts. And in fact, the Crusades is a convulsion of just that kind.
Which is why we wanted to take Jerusalem in the first place.
We
being the West.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Because it played a millennialist role in the medieval.
The millennialist reading of the First Crusade is that at least this is my reading, I can't say how many other people share it yet, but my reading is that when Jesus didn't come in the year 1000 and then again didn't come in the year 1033, the big question was, when is he going to come? And what happens often in these things is that when you passively await somebody to come and he doesn't come, when you passively await for the apocalyptic transformation, it doesn't happen, you start thinking up things that you can do. And so this is a sort of active pre-apocalyptic project, which is if we purify Jerusalem, the earthly Jerusalem is in the hands of the infidel. If we kick them out and purify it, then the heavenly Jerusalem will descend. Well, the heavenly Jerusalem didn't descend, but they managed to wade in blood through the cities of Jerusalem, singing, "This is the day the Lord gave us." One of the sort of laws of millennial studies is one person's Messiah is another person's Antichrist. When Hitler is the savior of the German people, he's the Antichrist of the Jews. And so very often what you get is not just one apocalyptic movement, but one apocalyptic movement triggers another, the way that, for instance, Jerry Falwell's remarks in many ways were sort of startlingly similar to bin Laden's remarks. And this is a good apocalyptic tradition, which we can go back to. But the point that I was making in that article, and I'd make about I'd like to make about Islam is that in the period of expectations, messianic expectations, as they begin to warm, very often Christian-Jewish relations warm. There's an attempt, and you see that right now in the United States, between the fundamentalists and the Jews. Fundamentalists are very pro-Zionist. They're very eager to help the Jews and so on. And it's not just a sort of strategic decision. There's a lot of enthusiasm and passion in this, and they approve wholeheartedly of Jews who observe the law, which is not a common phenomenon, certainly for somebody who studies Christianity in the Middle Ages. But what happens is when disappointment comes, a lot of this is focused on we're going to be nice to the Jews because then they'll convert. I mean, you know, if we force the Jews to convert at gunpoint or at sword point, that's not a real conversion. So we'll convert them by love bombing them. And so that leads to some very nice and very often economically extremely productive relations when commoners are getting along well. But then when the disappointment comes, there's a tendency to scapegoat the Jews and say, if only the Jews had converted, Jesus would have come, and he didn't come because they failed to convert, and this is a stiff-necked people. And then you move into the hostile stuff. And so what I was saying before the year 2000 is watch out, because there's very good relationships right now, but one of the bases, not the only, but one of the bases of that relationship is this Christian expectation that the Jews are going to convert. And when they don't, and when the rapture doesn't come, and so on and so forth, and life goes on as it will, it's possible that you're going to get disappointed people, sort of like, you know, somebody who had a crush in high school and gets disappointed and then develops an intense dislike for the very person that they were so passionately attracted to before. And I heard one of the evangelical Christians that I'm in contact with made a remark to me that I thought was really quite telling in this sense. He wrote me and he said, I'm afraid the American government is going to abandon Israel, but that's what has to happen, because only when Israel has been abandoned by all and loses all hope in help from man, then they will turn to God. So this ferociously pro-Zionist Christian is now ready to contemplate having Israel abandoned by the United States, placed in dire straits and threat of its existence, and then they'll turn to Jesus.
Speaking with Professor Richard Landis, he teaches medieval history at Boston University and is the director of the Center for Millennial Studies. Now, we have plenty of Christian millennialists as well, and I'm sure that they've been sent into a tizzy by these events. They've taken a lot of hits, too, because of Jerry Falwell's and Pat Robertson's inauspicious comments about the moral lassitude of the United States being responsible for September 11th. But what is their take on these Middle Eastern events?
I was listening to AM radio last night, and somebody called in to say that this has the sound of an urban legend, but that a son of a friend had his seventh grade teacher tell them that this is the Battle of Armageddon, and that the kid couldn't sleep at night, and so on and so forth. So
he was expecting to be raptured any minute.
Well, no, because you know, you're only going to be raptured if you're going to be saved. So it's possible that, you know, this is one of the ways that you call for repentance, and that's exactly what Jerry Falwell was trying to do. He was trying to say, look, here is this terrible event. What is the proper thing? Beat your breast. Self-criticize, which is also what the liberals are saying. They just have a different analysis of what we've done wrong. But, you know, and on one level, it's a healthy response. When bad things happen to you, you can blame other people. You can scapegoat. You can, or not even scapegoat. You can legitimately blame other people and say, you did this to me. But if you're going to go anywhere, you'll self-criticize. Jerry Falwell has engaged in a kind of apocalyptic self-criticism in which the forces that are polluting our culture, namely pagans and homosexuals and abortion doctors and so on and so forth, and I believe he mentioned the ACLU, that's what's wrong with us. And so, you know, he said this because he really does think that God will punish us for what we do wrong, and ultimately his patriotism is to God and not to the United States. And what he ran into was the buzzsaw of American patriotism precisely in the circles where he thought he had the most support. So he and Pat Robertson had to back off because, you know, all of a sudden, the people were hearing them say things that just were horrifying to a sort of basic common level patriotism that I think most Americans share.
During the Reagan administration, it was very disturbing for those of us who are progressives and aware of millennial phenomenon to discover that Reagan was, in fact, a premillennialist. He belonged to a sect that believed that the earth had to be destroyed in a fiery conflagration before the second coming could take place, and he, in fact, had his finger on the button.
That's right. He had a finger on the button, and he believed that the passage in Ezekiel about fire from the sky meant atomic nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. So, in other words, he was somebody who would be willing to use nuclear weapons because he believed that God wanted that as part of his plan. Mm-hmm. So that's a very frightening thing, and I think that it's terribly frightening to think about the government of Pakistan, in which somebody with a nuclear bomb would also think in those terms.
Now George W. is a closer friend to the evangelical right. than Reagan was.
Well, we don't know how close Reagan was, but that's one of the things I wanted to suggest, is not to say Reagan was a member of a Christian sect that believed in premillennialism. First of all, I would say millions and possibly tens of millions of Christians, fundamentalists, believe in premillennialism without being members of sects. And he referred to theologians, and I think, among others, he was talking about Hal Lindsey and sort of a whole chorus of premillennial exegetes who were like the late great Planet Earth and so on. So it was a more widespread phenomenon, but not so sectarian in the sense that it was this small, highly motivated group of people, etc. Okay. But I think what's interesting is that even though he believed in this, and even though you could say he flirted with it, ultimately his moves in international politics actually went in the direction of resolving things with the Russians rather than exacerbating them. And that, I think, represents, I think one of the things to always realize, and this is something that we millennial scholars and new religious movement scholars try and tell people in the FBI, is, every religious quote-unquote fanatic that you meet is not pre-programmed to go only one way. Depending on how you deal with them, they can go in different directions. And I think Reagan, fortunately, as I think Menachem Begin back in the 70s, were seduced by the idea, ultimately, that they should go down in history as peacemakers and not as Armageddon bringers. So, you're right that that was a concern, and I think it should still be a concern, but I think it's also important to understand that everything is embedded in a cultural context that can sometimes, if you will, pull the teeth of what could be very, very dangerous stuff. And what worries me about the Muslim and Arab world today is that the forces that would dampen the kind of cataclysmic active apocalypticism, which says, God wants me, in the famous words of Robert J. Lifton in his book on Om Shinrikyo, to destroy the world to save it, I don't feel there are enough strong elements in Arab and Muslim culture right now to pull people back and say, no, that's mad. That's mutual assured destruction.
I've been speaking with Richard Landis. He's the director of the Center for Millennial Studies at Boston University, where he teaches medieval history. Thanks so much for joining us, Richard.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the Infos Radio Project. Also, at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.